The previous view was much better.
But we have to use the other view for our website.
Okay, let's get back to work. Russ was going to give us a suggestion for how to proceed.
Well, my
Russ often says town meetings like that.
Yeah, I know. My observation is someone in paragraph 29 of the memo that basically says that we should require there be disaggregation, but allow rely on IS-1 and existing SEC financial reporting literature as to whether or not the information is of such a nature that it needs to be separately presented on the face. These pieces of literature have been designed for disaggregation in the face for all aspects of financial reporting, and I don't think that this particular thing needs to be presented differently than that. So I just say it has to be separately presented and rely on that as to whether or not it's okay to put in notes or on the face.
Okay. Do others agree with that suggestion?
I do.
I don't know what that means. Does it mean if it's material, it has to be in the face, sum to a total, and if it's not, it goes in the notes?
Yeah, although there's specific, at least in the SEC literature, quantification metrics as to whether or not it is material.
That's right. I mean, you always have the option to disaggregate on the face, but there's certain minimums. Like if your assets are of a certain level, and I forget what it is, 5% of assets or something. Along those lines, 10%. But then you have to break it out on the face according to SEC rules. Management often disaggregates more in the statement of financial position, and so management might decide, in addition to putting the investment in or lease assets, they could provide, because either way we're going to require the disaggregation. The staff isn't saying don't ever give me the pieces. We're just saying whether it goes on the face or in the notes.
The question is, in my mind, will the SEC interpret them to be separate assets?
If you say I see.
Investment and leased assets, they might be that. You know, I don't know how they'll interpret it.
I would rather signal it the other way. And say, I mean, to me, I think of the SEC rules as much more of when do I break out the things in other?
Yeah. I see.
And separately present that. These two things that we're putting into investment and leased assets are of such a different nature that I would rather signal that they have to be separately presented in separate line items and rely on materiality to say combine them. The other way around?
On Larry's note, I think we should say, and I think we are saying throughout this process, that they are separate assets. That they are recorded separately. They are tested for impairment separately. And so I think they are separate, that we are bundling under a total of investment and assets. So, but as far as whether or not you put it in the notes and say if it's material, put it on the face, or put it on the face and say if it's immaterial, you can just put it in the notes, I just think we have existing requirements to tell us how to do it. That's why I fall on the rely on other literature.
Okay, so the previous vote was a majority for presenting the two components together on the face of the balance sheet. I think we've got three choices here. One, don't require further disaggregation. Two, require further disaggregation on the face. Or three, require disaggregation in the notes, all of this subject to materiality.
These three, the notes or the face, depending right. on what you want.
I guess so. I guess you'd always be allowed to present it separately on the face. Okay, so let me test here. Who would support requiring the disaggregation on the face? That's two. Who would support permitting some flexibility between the face and the notes? That's five here.
And that's just a free choice.
Well, no, it's obviously governed by other disaggregation requirements, either in IS-1 for IFRS and SEC literature.
So the SEC literature is a writing gap for all companies, right, not just public companies.
Right.
So the SEC literature doesn't govern.
So then
they have
yes,
to disclose
it would be it. Flexible as to whether you do it on the face or in the notes. Hans, can I ask you to call the vote over there, because I'm having trouble seeing your group.
Yeah. Okay. So who would favor flexibility of disaggregation on the face and the notes. We have a clear majority here, too.
Okay, good. And I don't think we need to cover question one.
Okay.
Thank you. Nick, do you want to move on to the next paper?
Sure. The next paper is on the statement of cash flow. It's 2C, 199. The ED requires that lessors classify the cash flows related to leases in the operating section of the statement of cash flows. The majority of respondents agreed with this presentation. However, some respondents raised the issue that if a lease is a financing, then what the lessor has done is, in effect, issued a loan, and therefore the cash flows from the lease should be an investing activity and not an operating activity. And based on this feedback, the staff considered different ways to classify the cash flows of a lease transaction for lessors. This is complicated by the fact that IFRS and U.S. GAAP have different requirements for the statement of cash flows, and the paper goes into those differences. The staff contemplated three approaches to classifying lessor cash flows in paragraph 15 of this memo. Approach A was to retain the requirement in the ED, and that is to classify the cash flows as operating cash flows. Approach B would be to classify the cash inflows from a lease transaction as investing cash flows. Approach C would require that the cash inflows from a lease be presented as an operating cash flow unless the lessor acquired an asset subject to lease, the acquisition of title was directly linked to the asset being subject to that lease, and that payment was an investing cash outflow. If all three of those criteria were met, then the subsequent inflows would be classified as investing cash inflows. The staff thought that classifying all cash flows from leases as investing probably is not consistent with either IAS 7 or U.S. GAAP. Approach C was designed to match outflows and inflows related to investments made in lease assets by financial institutions. That's really who would get captured in Approach C. However, the staff notes that there is inconsistency between the statement of cash flow prepared under IFRS and U.S. GAAP for financial entities anyway. And there's disconnect between cash inflows and cash outflows related to the same asset right now under existing cash flow guidance. The paper did not contain a staff recommendation. However, the staff has discussed the issue with some constituents since issuance of the paper. I've also been able to attend a conference with a lot of preparers from banks. And I was reminded that the statement of cash flow for users of financial institutions is not exactly utilized right now anyway. And so Approach C does introduce complexity into the guidance to improve a statement of cash flows for entities where the users aren't exactly using the cash flow statement except to extract some information. So there isn't a recommendation in the paper, but I've leaned a little bit more towards Approach A, but I'll let the boards discuss.
Thank you. Questions, comments? Tom?
I've taken a similar journey, I think, to Nick. I had some sympathy at first to think about Approach C, but Approach C, after I followed on from question one to questions, whatever, two, three, and four, however many questions we end up with, where we end up breaking up the cash flows for a financial institution related to a lease into multiple categories, sort of blew my mind as to how that could be potentially useful for anyone trying to understand the cash flows from leasing activities, because you'd have to track them all around, build them back together and say, okay, there's the cash flow from the lease. So I thought Approach A is the best approach. And I think it also has the advantage of perhaps if both boards agreed, leading to a converged solution. Because if we went down the Approach C approach, we would not come to a converged solution.
Mark?
I agree with Nick's recommendation. I think about this in terms of how would a direct cash flow statement work? And to me, a direct cash flow statement would be, these are cash receipts from the lessor side, these are cash receipts from customers, and that operating cash flow. And so I think the simplest way to handle it is these are all operating cash flows. I think Approach C introduces a lot of complexity. I think today, Approach A would also address a lot of diversity in practice I see today, where I see an investment and lease, changes in investment and lease lines, sometimes in operating, sometimes in investing, sometimes changing from one period to the next, depending on which way it's going. So I really like the simplicity of Approach A. I think in U.S. GAAP, we have an issue with how we deal with financial institutions elsewhere, and we could and should deal with that elsewhere to make it more useful anyway, the cash flow statement. So I wouldn't be hindered from Approach A just because we have some different literature that users aren't finding helpful today. So I would be firmly in Approach A.
So I'm generally supportive of where you're going, but I do have a question. Mm-hmm. Would you feel differently if the lessor was a major securitizer?
I think a securitization of a lease would be different than becoming the lessor. Maybe I'm not exactly understanding.
I'm the lessor and I sell the receivable. Where right. do you put the cash envelope right. in the sell the receivable, investing or operating?
Okay, so I'm the lessor and I've, well, I mean, it would be no different than securitizing any of your receivables. It's a change in your receivable and it's an operating cash flow.
That was an investing.
I would have thought it was an investing.
Well,
for change in receivable? No. Oh, for, I'm sorry.
It does,
for,
so this, it
for financial institution.
Financial. Oh. So this is in retail companies, it's an operator.
Right, I'm sorry, I was answering the retail company. I wasn't answering the...
Securitizing receivable a retail company is operating?
Yes.
Yep.
Can't see it most.
Okay. I would...
Unless it's a very long term, well, I shouldn't... With the cash flow statement, I've learned never to be...
Well, that's where
I think that at least, I have a similar was when we're answering this question, is it inflows from the lessee, or is it all inflows, which would include securitization?
I see.
May I just ask you both a question? Why would simply adding a liquidity feature to this collection of leases change operating to investment? I mean, because quite often, all you're doing is giving yourself additional flexibility. You pay a little bit, but you're giving you flexibility for adding liquidity to the balance sheet.
It gets to a situation where Mark says he wants operating because he believes this is cash inflows from a customer, which would be the lessee. But a cash inflow from the person you are selling the receivables for is not your customer. And if I were to purchase the lease receivable, I probably wouldn't call that an operating cash outflow.
If you were to purchase it simply as an investment, I can accept that as an investment. But if you're the lessor, which I felt was Leslie's original question, if you're the lessor, all you're doing is adding that liquidity to your balance sheet. And that shouldn't change from operating to investment, from my perspective.
Right. I mean, my basic question was, does all mean all here?
Yeah.
Right.
I think.
Right.
Yeah. And frankly, I'm not necessarily remembering this exactly right. There's probably a distinction between securitizations for a financial institution and securitizations of loans or receivables from unloading companies. I'm not saying this. In which case, there's no issue.
Right.
Right.
Or in practice, maybe something happens that because
yeah.
I'm kind of with Mark from a I wasn't thinking financial institution, but it's my change in receivables, which are reported in operating, and it kind of flows through there in the cash flow statement. But
okay,
are we answering? It seems like we're answering the question where the cash flows and the lessees would go, and if it becomes securitized, whatever, however securitizations are treated will govern the cash flow.
I think that's fair.
Okay, that works.
Okay. Does anyone disagree with that? So it's basically view A subject to any override if there's a different treatment for the cash flows of a securitized lease receivable.
So we'll have a disconnect or... It will not be treated the same as collection activities related to loans.
Right.
Right.
So I just have a question about what we would put in the basis. Because from a lessee perspective, we're linking the cash flows to PP&E. For a lessor perspective, we are not linking the cash flows to a receivable or a loan, but yet the impairment analysis is like a loan, although I'll recognize our measurement classification is not like a loan. So we're just saying it has some aspects of a loan and other aspects not like a loan. That's our basis? Or is our basis, because IFRS is clear that a loan is an operating and convergence is more important here?
What I heard Mark saying was that, you can correct me if I'm wrong, was he didn't like how loans are treated in the statement of cash flows for financial institutions to begin with, so why continue down that same path?
And it's not converged, and this is complex.
Yes, all those things.
And to Nick's point, nobody looks at the cash flow statement.
For the life of me, I don't know. There must have been some logic behind this, but we're talking about this is a loan, which would seem to be a financing activity rather than an investing activity. I don't know how they got to investing.
Okay, so
it's the issuance of a loan. If a bank issues a loan, that's an investing activity under U.S. GAAP.
Leslie probably won't hear this, but I recognize that that's our basis. I'd like to throw out that as we move forward on our AFI project, to reconsider where you put loans in the statement of cash flows in that.
Right.
Okay, fair enough. Okay, so one more time for the record. Do people support view A unless it's as part of a securitization?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, I have 7 for that. Over to you.
What is, can we support view A here? Twelve.
Okay.
Any other questions, sir? Not needed.
Oh, Nick is informing us that based on our good performance on that question, we're going to answer the rest of the questions in this memo.
Now I understand your recommendation.
Well done. Okay, we're moving to the next one with Danielle.
Yes.
Okay,
thank
Danielle
you.
Will help us.
Is going to
walk us through
that. Memo 2G203 discusses the general transition requirements and disclosures for lessees upon adoption of the proposed lease requirements. There are some specific transition issues that the staff will address in separate memos. This memo also does not discuss the effective date of the proposed standard. The ED proposed a simplified retrospective approach. Although almost all respondents supported the proposal not to require a full retrospective approach because of the cost and complexity for preparers, many respondents had concerns with the profit or loss front-loading effect of the simplified retrospective approach. Users highlighted comparability concerns with the simplified retrospective approach as well. The majority of respondents, excluding users, supported permitting but not requiring entities to fully retrospectively apply the guidance. However, users were concerned with this suggestion because a choice would create inconsistencies. The first section of this memo in paragraphs 24 through 38 discusses general transition requirements. The staff presents 3 approaches, a full retrospective approach, a modified retrospective approach, which differs from the simplified retrospective approach proposed in the ED, and an optional full retrospective approach with the modified retrospective approach as the alternate approach. The staff rejected both the simplified retrospective approach proposed in the ED because of comments received and the prospective approach because any information provided by such an approach would not be beneficial to users. The staff recommendation is in paragraphs 39 through 42 of this memo and notes that the staff are split between either the retrospective approach or the modified retrospective approach. Some staff members believe the full retrospective approach gives users the best and most comparative information, and although they acknowledge the cost concerns noted by preparers, do not think any form of modified retrospective approach would be any less costly. However, other staff members, although they also think full retrospective gives the best information, think a modified retrospective approach would be less costly while still providing users of financial statements with useful information. Which approach do the boards prefer?
Thank you. Quick question to kick off. The scope of this discussion is only lessees?
Yes.
And so you would bring back to us a separate discussion on lessors where we might potentially reach a different answer?
I guess you could potentially reach a different answer, and we could either revisit or...
Which could cause a problem on subleasing activities.
I'm just curious why it's being brought this way.
I think that we didn't feel like we were prepared to discuss transition on lessor when we hadn't made some decisions regarding some of the, you know, the residual asset received.
Okay, other questions?
So do we want to make decisions and then revisit them again?
Well, why don't we have a discussion and see if there might be a general leaning. I'm not suggesting we would reach a different conclusion, but I just thought it was a little unusual.
And we do have additional transition issues that we would bring back to you on, you know, families back subleases and make sure that we are all set up. This is just kind of, okay, generally speaking for the lessee, what do we think the right answer is for transition based on the decisions we've made to date on the lessee model, which is a little more fully developed than the lessor model.
I support full retrospective here because of the impact we're having on the lessee's net income and the operating cash flow. I think that those are both metrics that are important, and the investors are going to need to understand the trend analysis. So I'd be supportive of full retro. Happy to talk about some of the additional reliefs within full retro when we get there, but I think full retro should be the primary goal here.
I was going to say, I support full retro. You may have some small cost savings on the preparer side, but you're just transferring that burden over to the investor, and I don't think there's any net cost savings, so as a result, let's do the approach.
Okay.
Other
points?
Full retro.
Okay. I'm going to ask IASB members whether they have any questions or comments.
Paul? I'm just going to make my a comment that I've made to our staff, because this is an issue, and it's in paragraph 4 at the beginning of the paper, that has come up in other of our projects as well. I don't know if FASB considered this. And that is whether an effective date of a standard can be as of a date of the beginning of an interim period or only the beginning of an annual period. We have an interim reporting standard here, and that standard says very clearly that accounting changes should be made only at the beginning of an annual period for pretty obvious benefit to users of financial statements and confusion in comparability from company to company if companies can pick an interim date. And if we have multiple standards allowing interim dates to for new standards, comparability is hopeless. Our staff have said to me that when it says in paragraph 4, which may be an interim period, they don't mean that to say the entity first applies the standard as of an interim date. So I just want to say that my view in all cases, and we've had this in almost all of our standards, in IFRS 13, our last standard is very clear, apply at the beginning of an annual period. And so I hope this standard and others will follow that policy that we've set out in IAS 34, paragraphs 44 and 45.
Okay. Any other comments? Very good. Can you push this button?
Before votes, can I ask questions? If we vote for full retrospective applications, whether the next question will be meaningless?
The next question is for either approach.
I think you still would ask those following questions.
Yes. Right? I think either if you did the full or modified, I think the staff supports some reliefs, you know, consistent with REVRA.
But if we vote for, then we say that we give you relief, whether this can be still called full retrospective application?
We may just need to look at the terminology. Then when we draft, I think what we're saying is the basis that it's full retrospective, but then within a full retrospective model, would we allow, you know, any particular relief? So I think that, to your point, if we go ahead when we discuss some of the specific reliefs and we conclude that we think there are some of those reliefs we want to give, that maybe that when we actually draft, we shouldn't call it full retrospective. We just make sure the words reflect exactly how we intend this to be applied.
But my sense is, you know, maybe my guess is wrong. Maybe FS board members or our board members will accept some of the reliefs. Then I will call it modified rather than full. Otherwise, we'll confuse people, confuse ourselves. We call for retrospective applications, but then we say we give you relief. It is modified.
I think at least on our side, we're trying to be more descriptive when we talk about transition generally anyway, because the words we use tend to be quite technical for people trying to use the standards. So to your point, we'd make sure that it was clear exactly what we were requiring.
Okay. Are there any other comments on Stephen?
The problem we had when we issued the ED was that full retrospective was regarded as very onerous. Now, obviously, we've made changes since then in terms of options and variable lease payments, which makes it less onerous. But my question is, are we confident that we're going to get positive support for this and that we're not going to suddenly discover in our exposure process that it's still extremely onerous, and we're given a whole series of reasons why that is? And I recognize that, I mean, I agree that it's not full retrospective. Quite clearly, if we do these modifications here, it's not. And the modified approach that's described earlier on is a similar type of it's just a different modification, and the modification is not having to go back and use the original discount rate. It's using the discount rate at the transition date, so it's just another element of modification. So are we confident that this is enough in order to resolve the operational issues that were identified when we did the ED? I presume we're going to ask a question on this.
Absolutely. I mean, are we confident? No, I can't say that. I can say everybody will tell us that this is easy and straightforward and it won't cost them. I know that, you know, from some of the preparer side of things, they it was more the preparers that suggested. Actually, some of the preparers actually said as well, you shouldn't be preventing people doing kind of full retrospective if they choose to, but it was more the preparer side of feedback that would say they'd be keen on, you know, the optionality, allowing either a full retrospective or some sort of, you know, modified or approach. As I say, it was just then the feedback from the user side that said to us that allowing any kind of optionality, that they were very much opposed to that from comparability reasons. So I mean, we can certainly ask a question.
It looks like we're going to allow optionality with these various reliefs, because these are themselves presumably going to be options. So is there such a problem in allowing some optionality in terms of going back and reassessing the discount rate? I'm just not so sure that full the modified full retrospective is really the best way for us to go here.
I thought part of the rationale behind the staff's recommendation was that we had made a number of simplifications to the model during our redeliberations, which would presumably reduce the cost of applying the standard upon transition and also on a going forward basis.
Amaru?
It's just, I guess it's in the same line as Steve, but a little bit different, and taking into consideration a point made by Leslie. I personally don't feel truly comfortable in deliberating this for lessee, for one leg of the model. I would prefer deliberating transition for both lessors and lessees. I understand it was already explained by the staff why you are bringing lessee now. My question is, when do you intend to bring the lessor transition? And wouldn't be wiser for us to consider both lessees and lessors in one meeting instead of now deliberating about lessee and then suddenly discovered points, as Steve mentioned here, about one model or one modification or other that might suggest us to rediscuss the lessee to have the same transition method for lessors and lessees, especially, I guess, was Leslie that mentioned the subleases and sales and leasebacks as well.
I mean, to respond to your question of when we plan to bring lessor transition paper, that's to the next joint meeting, so the October.
So 1 month only. And my view is that we are going to spend time here deliberate, and 1 month we are going to deliberate on lessors, and then suddenly in the middle of the deliberation, or even during the development of the paper for lessors, the staff discovers something that understand is necessary to bring to our attention, take into consideration the decision, the tentative decision we are making today.
If I understood Leslie, though, I think the suggestion was that we just get a read on what people are thinking now, and then the staff could build that into their thinking for the next paper, which could be both sides. Is that right?
But my concern is distinct from Leslie. Mine is that I don't know the others, but I don't feel comfortable in deliberating now for lessee and in 1 month deliberating again for lessor, and suddenly discover that the decision that I'm making today is not truly...
But you're not making a decision.
A tentative decision.
We're not even doing that. I think, for example, the feedback Steve gave was something for us to think about, so I think that's all the intentions.
Well, Philippe?
Thanks. Well, again, the difficulty with any transition is that we are trying to find one solution only for very different situations. Basically, there are companies which have few contracts, maybe important, where the effect of front-loading, if they don't do full retrospective, could be significant, and there would be a distortion to the results. On the other side, you have companies with many, many different contracts of smaller items, smaller tickets, and to say you have to do full retrospective, then the cost of doing that vis-à-vis the benefits of the full retrospective application is not that big. So I think, if we want to be realistic, we have to give the option as an accounting policy choice either to do full retrospective, and then there is a motivation because the cost is limited because there are not many contracts, and the motivation because of the front-loading effect and usefulness for the users of not having the front-loading distortion is there, they will go for this. On the other side, if the cost of restating is very high and the effect of front-loading is not that big, then they will do the modified retrospective approach.
But the modified approach deals with the front-load.
Yeah, no, but still it doesn't do exactly the same as a full retrospective. So there is still some, maybe less of a distortion than before, but there's still an impact, I think. Or I need to understand why we have totally eliminated the impact of not doing a full retrospective. So maybe I'm not yet quite there. But so I think we ought to give this accounting policy option to say either full retrospective or modified retrospective, but not pick and choose contract by contract. Do it as an accounting policy choice for the whole of the contracts. And yes, there will be maybe not that much comparability between different entities, but at least there will be more comparability over time for one given entity. So it's always transition is a choice between comparability between entities or within an entity over time between years. In this case, what we lose on one side, we gain on the other one.
Jan?
Well, in the end, I think I end up very much where Philippe is. But before that, I would really question if we are in need of having the full retrospective analysis. Are we really helping people to make economic decisions by having the difference between these two models? And when I just see the wording here, I get the impression that you get good enough with a retrospective modified approach. So like Amaro said, let's decide next week and next month, and perhaps I end up where Philippe is. But I think with the modified approach would most likely be sufficient. And I would be very interested to understand a little bit more how you estimate what would really be the differences when you see a balance sheet.
Doc?
Yes, I share the nearly same view with Philip, and the reason is it is not good to prohibit full retrospective, because there are companies who just want to full retrospective. But if we require full retrospective like approach A, there are companies who doesn't have record of the leasing, it's all off balance, it's quite difficult. So then, of course, those companies, it is not possible to make a retrospective presentation. Then, in that case, as a relief, we could use the plan like approach B, that would work. So we need, basically, we ask retrospective. But in the case, if it is difficult, impossible, then use plan B. And the approach, you do not ask the question in the approach C. Approach C is not the one with the candidate. But, of course, I understand accounting choice is not good. But in the case, full retrospective is not possible. As a second best, B approach would work.
I want to ask a question here. If I use a full retrospective, the interest rate that I need to take into consideration for the lessee would be the then incremental borrowing rate at the date of inception of the lease. And if I do a modified retrospective, what would be the lease interest rate at the date of transition? Is that the big difference between the two? How does the incremental borrowing rate come into the play?
I'll answer this, but maybe I'll hand over to Danielle or Kristen to correct me if I'm wrong. My understanding about the difference between modified and the full retrospective is, in fact, the liability calculation would be the same under both, so that the way you calculate the liability, including the interest rate, would be the same as a full retrospective approach. It's the relief would come through in how you measure the asset, in a sense. So the liability would be calculated the same as full retrospective, and the asset may or may not be different depending on the terms and conditions. But I'd say maybe Kristen or Danielle, correct me if I have got that wrong.
Katrina, you're correct. The actual interest rate that we would use under either one, we would be in the other issues paper. But you're correct that the liability would be calculated the same and the relief is in the right of use asset.
And
I'm not sure that's correct. Full retrospective to me means going back to the day you signed the lease,
Calculate
the incremental borrowing rate on that day, then roll both the asset and the liability forward with all the changes and everything else, subject to any additional release we give. Modified retrospective, as defined here, would be using the discount rate, the incremental borrowing rate, at the date of transition.
And you roll that back.
Yeah. And then you recalculate the asset based upon a rollback to get what the asset is.
So the point
I'm... Not the same. Look, A and B have a different discount rate. B has the same discount rate that we proposed in the ED. That's where the similarity is. And the difference between B and the approach in the ED is on the asset side. The liability is the same as we proposed in the ED.
So would it not, if I have a 30-year lease and I'm in that year 22 on the date of transition, would it not be sensible to use the discount rate on the date of transition as opposed to going back 22 years and do it? And so I think we should not underestimate. Last week, Daryl Buck and I had earful about the, and rightfully so, about the problems that we can get for the so-called trend analysis in retrospective in all cases. And I am convinced that sometimes perhaps it is not sensible to put people to that kind of inconvenience when there is incremental informational aspect is not so high. And so, and as your footnote tells in the example, if the incremental borrowing rate doesn't change with the rate implicit in the lease, and the lease payments are straight line, perhaps you get the same answer. Otherwise, it's going to be a different answer. And I think we got to take that into consideration very seriously, because it's going to be a humongous task. Thousands and thousands of leases have to be recalculated this way. And I think got to pause here and just not jump into the bandwagon of full retrospective with full both the legs. Thanks.
So do we need to put a question to the table here?
Anything, Hans?
Well, I'm not sure, Leslie. Is it time to have a vote, or do we not vote on this?
I'd rather not vote today.
No.
I think we've heard some useful information. Another point that I would just like to raise is that I think that there's a need for us to think about whether we need to have consistent transition for lessors as we have in revenue recognition. And then the point Russ made before, then you know, take it the next step. You need symmetry between the transition for lessees and lessors in the event that there is subleasing going on. I'm asking that as a sincere question. But so I would propose that we defer a vote today and then try and have more of a comprehensive vote when the staff is ready, presumably next month. But
that's fine.
Okay. Tom, did you have a question?
I have a different issue that we have not put on the table for either revenue recognition or leases that I think perhaps we overlooked, or maybe we didn't. The users, we did the outreach on effective dates and transitions more broadly for a bunch of different projects. And one of the issues that the users raised was the quality of the information they'd receive during the period of ramping up to when it went into effect. That would be equivalent to what's happening under SAP 74 disclosures in the United States. But we didn't talk about the potential of addressing that issue in revenue recognition. My fear is that we may be leaving that behind. I'm not saying necessarily what the conclusion would be, but I'm very hopeful that we at least make an evaluation as to whether we talk all the time about how we can make it transition work better for the preparer. There is also an issue about making transition work better for the user that suggests that they might want to begin to understand before things go in effect, but as things, if we're going retrospective, as companies are getting familiar with what the implications would be, what sort of disclosures we could systematically be giving the users to understand what the directional impacts would be, the magnitude of the impacts, to help them begin to ramp up to being able to use the data when it becomes effective. And I would hope that I want to at least raise the issue as to whether we want staff to investigate that more broadly, not within one project, but more generally at this time.
I think the staff included a brief discussion on transition disclosures as part of this memo. I'm presuming you would bring transition disclosures relating to leasing as part of the next memo. I know we've had that conversation before. I think there are questions about whether it's something we should do or whether the SEC should consider as part of a review of SAP 74. So why don't we, I understand your point with respect to this team and this project. I think as part of the transition discussion, let's make sure we're including any transition disclosures.
Just on your point, Tom, under IFRS, we do actually have something along these lines in IAS 8 at the moment.
Paragraph 30. Okay. What sort of reaction have you been receiving about those disclosures? Are they of the quality and usefulness that the users think, or are they satisfied, or is there something worth evaluating?
Thomas Allen here. We actually asked this question at an advisory council meeting and got quite mixed feedback. We separated our advisory council into preparers and users and got extreme views, and that some of the user community wanted us to actually ramp up the disclosure requirements and effectively require full performers leading up to first-time implementation of the new standards, whereas the preparers actually asked us to step in, if anything, and reduce the requirements and say that you only needed to, for example, provide that information in the year immediately before first-time adoption. And then mixed views from the auditors thought that the requirements are actually fine. At the moment, obviously, we normally have much shorter timeframes leading up to standards, and so far we haven't heard any major issues at all about this. What's different in here is potentially allowing very long lead times.
Right. Tom, this is Lily here. To respond to your user questions, when we did the user outreach, a number of users gave us some feedback on some of the additional disclosures that they would like to have, and we're still researching on that. Thanks.
Okay, anything else on leasing for today? Can we take a 10-minute break and then resume on financial instruments? Does that work for you? Okay.